Cool. Thank you, Matt. Thanks for organizing the student seminar. It's great to be here. So yeah, my name is Evan Peters. I'm going to talk about classical learning guarantees from entanglement manipulation. It's sort of an intersection of machine learning and quantum information. Hopefully you're interested in at least one of those if you showed up. And it's a short talk. It's only 15 minutes, so feel free to jump in. Otherwise, we'll have some free time at the end. So I'm going to talk about two main points here. The first one is a sort of information theoretic guarantee for a classical learning task. And I'm going to talk about what that task is and what it means to have a guarantee for a task and why that's interesting. And then the second is a sort of scheme for generalizing like this learning task to the realm of quantum information, and trying to pick out certain things that seem to align really nicely, like a lot of reasoning by analogy, but then checking things work out rigorously. So this guarantee will describe sort of an onset of learning. And what this means is you have a classical data set, or some sequence of data that nature has given you, and you want to figure out something about nature. And I want to answer the question, when can you find something out? Like, when is there a guarantee that you can learn something about nature given this data? And then this quantum generalization, it's sort of thinking you have some like quantum information and you want to like manipulate it, like quote unquote learn from it, but you might want to do so in a way that preserves coherence. What can we say about that kind of task? And what can we say about recovering learning in general as a limit of that task? Okay, so I've been talking about learning, and I want to formalize that problem a bit. So nature samples an unknown vector alpha, and we can say it's like a d-dimensional vector without too much loss of generality, but it is from a kind of bounded or like compact set. It can't be from the continuum. And then you receive data based on what this value of alpha was. And this data is very abstract at this point, intentionally. But I'll talk about examples of what data might look like. And your goal as a learner is you want to estimate the alpha with a estimator alpha hat. And you want it to be a good estimation, so you want to be like epsilon close to alpha. And you can decide how good of an estimate you want by tuning epsilon. And more specifically, we can, for every estimate you output, we can give it a score. And we want that score to depend on the distance between alpha hat and alpha, but maybe we want some like higher penalties for bigger distances than linear scoring would provide. Okay, so that's abstract. Here's a concrete example. Say you want to learn an unknown hyperplane. The data you might be given could be a sequence of like XY pairs. And so maybe X is like a vector in RD, and Y is, it's like you take the inner product of this vector with some unknown plane, and then you maybe noise it up a bit. And your goal is to find this unknown alpha given that data set. And B is the entire data set, it's not just an element of that sequence. Okay, so you output an alpha hat, and you want to minimize like the L2 distance. That's a reasonable thing to do, because we're in a vector space. And in that case, your scoring function is sort of quadratic in the distance, and the distance is just your typical L2. Now, if you've ever done like line best fits in Excel or any kind of linear relationship between variables, you'll notice that this looks very similar. In fact, this is a like always harder problem than finding the line best fit to some set of data. And that's good for the kind of bounds that I want to show, because if you can show a guarantee for this task in terms of the data you've been given, then you know that you can already have a guarantee for linear regression from that. And linear regression, if you're not aware, it's a very ubiquitous task in modeling. Okay, so here is the learning guarantee, and let's go through this piece by piece. But you'll take a random variable, and you'll distribute it on a discretization of that blob that I showed or talked about before, that compact set the alpha comes from. then you look at the best case score that you get for this choice of unknown parameter. So here's that score we had before. There's your like nonlinearity, and then there's the distance. Because we have a stochastic relationship between alpha and nature and ourselves, right? There's always some kind of like noise or jitter. You need some kind of expectation over the kind of estimate you make, right? And now what does best case mean? There's sort of two different parts to best case. You get to use the optimal estimator. So we're maximizing over all of the alpha hats that we could have generated. But then nature is sort of cooperating by trying to maximize your score over the unknown alpha. And this is the tricky part. So like this makes the task easier than any other alpha you could have been given, but not trivially easy. You can't just trivially get like d equals zero from this because there's no direct communication between you and nature. Okay, so there's sort of a cooperation going, but no actual communication. So that's the left-hand side. And what is the right-hand side? If we look at this and we break it down, we have this score for having achieved an epsilon accurate estimate. So this is basically a good enough score for your choice of epsilon, bar the log. But then you subtract the conditional entropy. And I'm not going to define the conditional entropy here, but I will say in the classical case, it is close enough to the uncertainty of A given B. And remember, A was our discretization of that blob, and B was the data that we were given. So now we've reduced the left-hand side to a really simple formula, which says, how uncertain are you about a point on your discretization given whatever data you started with? Now, the discretization needs to be a particular one, which I'll just show in pictures here. This is that set A that alpha is drawn from, and I put alpha as a star here. What you need to do with this discretization is you need to cover it up with balls. And these are all circles, and every point needs to be contained in one such circle. And once you've done that, the way of the like the inequalities that we're trying to find means that you can actually discard the set entirely, and now you actually just have this set of discrete points in the plane, right? So then we've reduced our problem to, I have a bunch of these discrete points. How do I figure out which point that was drawn by nature given our observations B? And that's how we get to classical hypothesis testing. So the answer to that question involves discrete classical random variables. So I'll represent such variables as like double lines in diagrams like these. And what we do is you start by a pair of random variables, R and A, that are distributed in a discrete set now, sampled from some joint distribution. And A here is playing the role of alpha before, but like a discrete version of alpha, right? We've thrown away the continuum and we just have some large but not infinite set. You take that discrete choice of alpha and you pass it through a channel N that represents kind of nature generating data stochastically. And then you get this set of data B that comes out of that channel. And it depends on the value of A. Then the learner gets to take in that data B and it tries to predict A with a estimate A hat. And it uses this estimator channel D to do this. I said channel, but I meant stochastic map. That's a spoiler alert, I guess, for where we're going. So then the learner's optimal probability of success here, it turns out to obey a really nice inequality. If you maximize over these stochastic maps that take in data and output estimates, then the probability of successfully matching the reference variable is related to the conditional entropy of argument B. And now we see exactly where the right-hand side of the guarantee that I gave before comes from. Right? So this is the uncertainty of this variable R given B. I've switched up R for A here because we're going to now go into the quantum world where we care about a reference system. So this is the diagram that we just saw, but we're going to change this task up kind of drastically by substituting every classical random variable for a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So now these lines kind of represent those finite finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and you can define states on any set of lines that you want. And now we start with, instead of a correlated state between the reference and A, an entangled state between the reference and A, right? So it's, it's the quantum version of correlations. Nature now applies a CPTP map to some part of that reference state instead of a stochastic channel, and it prepares some quantum system B, which is then passed to the learner, who puts this through their own channel and tries to, instead of making two classical random variables equal, he now wants to maximize the entanglement of this final system in a very particular sense. So what does maximizing entanglement mean in this context? We're going to pick a quantity called the optimal singlet fraction. And what we have is, the thing we're interested in is the overlap of the final state that we've applied this channel to with a maximally entangled state on the same system. And so this thing will be one if you can recover a pure canonically maximally entangled state. And we don't care about the basis because we're maximizing over local channels. And it will be less than one if you can't do that. And this satisfies a very similar inequality to the classical problem, except instead of a conditional entropy, we have a conditional von Neumann entropy on this right-hand side. But this now has a very different interpretation than the sort of intuitive one that talks about the uncertainty of some variable given some data. This is now not a intuitive number. And in fact, it can be negative, and you can get a much bigger number on the right-hand side here than you would in the kind of classical analog. So just to review so far, we started talking about classical learning, but then I changed the subject and I talked about classical hypothesis testing. But then I showed you how we can get from one to the other and kind of preserve some bounds via a discretization argument. So we can bound this by discretization. And I changed the topic again and I made everything quantum. But you have to trust me that if you apply sort of a dephasing to this system, you'll recover the classical thing again. Right, so I talked about this, but this is a strict generalization of the classical hypothesis setting. Well, the thing that I'm interested in goes in this corner, okay? So now what I'd like to find and talk about a bit here, but not too much, is what is a interpretable quantum task that we can define which appropriately discretizes to this task of maximizing entanglement and also dephases in some sense to recover classical learning. So I'll talk a little bit about that now. And I'll just call this the quantum generalization of learning. It's not a unique generalization, but it's one that you could choose. And I'll compare it to the discrete version of that quantum task that I talked about before. So before, you started with this pure entangled state on the reference system plus Alice, and you can always write that in Schmidt form so that it looks like it's in some highly entangled basis. We want to generalize this to an initial state in continuous variables now, but we can't get maximum entanglements on the continuum. That doesn't really make sense. And so what you have to do is you have to pick sort of a fudge factor, and instead of having kind of basis kets that are equal to each other, we have a basis ket R, and then we have a set of basis kets that are kind of in a delta ball around R, right? And then you can check that this state, this is a bounded and normalizable operator, or describes a bounded normalizable operator. And we can then play around with these Schmidt coefficients the same way that you can for the optimization of the original task. Then, before, when Bob received part of this system subjected to a channel, he wanted to maximize overlap with this, it's called the singlet, up to normalization, and it's the maximally entangled state in finite dimensions. But we can't do that either, because we still don't have maximum entanglement. And so we can do the same strategy as before, where we pick some state that is, it looks kind of maximally entangled up to some epsilon fudge factor. And then this epsilon factor is chosen specifically with that distance bound from the continuum learning problem before. So if you allow for this epsilon factor here, this is the thing that's going to become the epsilon that the classical learner tried to get a distance upper bounded by in their learning task. But then is there a strictly stronger quantum version of the inequality that I showed before, right? So I'm kind of promising you that up to dephasing arguments, this will recover the continuous learning task. It'd be nice if up to discretization arguments, it recovers the discrete quantum singlet task. It's still to be seen. Then can you find some kind of nice lower bound that says up to a cooperative reference system and up to optimization of your channels, you can maximize the overlap between this very entangled state and the part of the initial state that you received from nature. And this is kind of abstract, so I'll summarize and talk about why this might be interesting as my final slide. To summarize what classical learning is a single sentence, it's you want to learn some algorithm or map D that takes in data and produces a joint probability distribution between your unknowns alpha and the estimates alpha hat that's highly correlated. Right? That's sort of a very brief summary of what it means to learn something. And if that's true, then alpha hat is generally very close to alpha, no matter what the choice of channel that nature imposes is. This generalized task is saying, okay, let's learn some CBTP map such that the joint system in the continuous variables between the reference and this final system alpha hat is highly entangled. Right, so I just kind of swap out the word highly correlated for highly entangled and then show with math that things work out nicely. And reasons I think this might be an interesting thing to look at and I'm looking into now is that if you can find analogous bounds on this generalized task, then it sort of describes like limits to how you can manipulate quantum data in a coherent way, in a way that preserves entanglement with a reference system. This also tells you things about what you might be able to do for teleportation given a continuous variable system. It's known that this like optimal singlet fraction describes your resources for doing teleportation in finite dimensional systems. And if this is the continuous variable task that's analogous to this optimal singlet fraction, it should describe something about teleportation in continuous variables. And then it would be nice if we could look into sort of like resources for learning that are like natively quantum, right? So you have sort of access to something that's very entangled. What now can you do with it that you couldn't have done with just strictly classical correlations? And with that, I will say thank you and take any questions. Yeah, that's hard to say. Right, so if you look at the form of that state, it's, look at like this like entangled state. It's, you know that as you shrink epsilon, it becomes like more entangled in some sense, but it's never diagonal. And so it's never, like because we're dealing with L2, right, you have some like countably infinite like spectral form for the state, right? So there's a summation over like the eigenfunctions. But if you don't know what those eigenfunctions are, you can't really talk about like the effective rank of that sequence. And I don't know what the eigenfunctions of this are as a function of epsilon. I think that would be very hard to figure out. Yeah, but like something that might work out better, which is what I will eventually work on, is this is a very generic choice here to talk about an epsilon ball. It's not very physical. You could instead talk about like a pair of like coupled harmonic oscillators and prepare them in some very entangled state, and then take the temperature to like infinity, and as you like bump up that temperature, you get this like set of infinite. You get like a set of eigenstates. You get that spectral form that looks more localized and looks more like higher entropy locally, which implies like higher entanglements bipartite. So yeah, hopefully it won't be abstract once I pick an actual physical system.
I'm just wondering too when you define your like cost function of your channel fidelity computers. Can you interpret that as like a joint matrix?
Almost. So the thing that's missing is that for this to be like, so like this would be the Choi matrix expectation value with respect to a maximally entangled state if the reference system was initially maximally entangled. Right, but you have this like freedom in the coefficients of psi RA. But if you pick the one that is maximally entangled, then yeah, it's exactly the overlap of a Choi matrix.
Do you have some freedom then?
Yeah, and I didn't go super into that, but the corresponding best case scenario in the quantum place is maximization over like the state on the initial like reference plus alpha, because you can't pick a specific alpha to like maximize with respect to, as you did in the classical case. You have to like preserve the entire quantum state in the maximization. Otherwise, it's like you applied a measurement at some point if you only keep like a single basis element. Yeah. So the maximally entangled state is in there, but there's these funny results too about like optimizing singlet fraction where like sometimes inputting the maximally entangled state is not the optimal strategy, which is something I'm still trying to wrap my head around, but it happens. This discretization?
Yeah. Like, could you decide to break down and try to find this balance and continue this stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, just talking about the classical case, which will obviously extend to the quantum case, things like conditional entropy are really, really poorly. They're really uninterpretable in the continuum. Like the relative entropy stays pretty interpretable, but like the conditional entropy gets really strange in infinite dimensions. The standard Shannon entropy gets really strange. It takes on like negative values or something sometimes. So I haven't really looked into, right, like information theoretic quantities on the continuum, but it's easy enough to discretize. Right, and then everything has like really nice interpretation, and then you can like describe what you need to perform a learning task in terms of bits, which is nice, instead of whatever the unit of like the logarithm of a relative entropy on the continuum is.
And you also know how small epsilon should be. Is there a reason to be that? It's also how much.
Right, right. So like, if you imagine epsilon was gigantic, right? And you only needed a single ball to cover the space, then you will always succeed because you're trying to guess which ball your star was contained in, and there's only one ball. So you have perfect success probability with a gigantic epsilon. But what happens is each time you shrink epsilon, you introduce more balls, it gets harder to find out which ball it was in as epsilon gets smaller. And so it's really up to the learner where they want to pick epsilon to be, because the bound gets like increasingly difficult. I guess generically, it gets increasingly difficult as you shrink epsilon, because there's way more balls to try to find out.
So it depends on the task. So it depends from one task or another. Some learners prefer small epsilon, some others larger epsilon.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about like the linear regression task, it's like how much wiggle room do you want in the line best fit compared to the true line? How much do you tolerate? Maybe it depends on the kind of data you're going to generalize to, where you can like, you know, make like a Lipschitz argument about how bad the y values will vary depending on the dimensionality and the epsilon that you introduce. But like, yeah, it really does depend.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, so much.